You're listening to Naked Oceans with Helen Scales and me, Sarah Castor-Perry. This month, we're talking about seagrasses. These are the flowering plants that colonise the shallow seas, growing in lush meadows across tropical and temperate zones. But like many coastal habitats, they're in decline around the world. I chatted with marine ecologist Emmett Duffy from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science about the problems seagrasses are facing and to find out more about his research investigating what happens when species are lost from seagrass ecosystems.
Well, seagrasses face a lot of the same threats that many other ocean habitats do. On a local level, they're threatened by nutrient pollution, runoff from land, farms, and domestic regions, which causes algae to overgrow them, and also soil erosion, which causes the water to be turbid and dirty. The seagrasses are plants, of course, so they need a lot of light and they need clear water to grow. On a global scale, seagrasses are threatened by climate change as well. Like corals, they tend to be, at least in temperate areas like North America and Europe, they tend to be living near their upper thermal tolerances, meaning that a little bit of a rise in temperature can push them over a tipping point. And we're beginning to see that both in the Chesapeake Bay here in the U.S. As well as in the Mediterranean.
And what would it mean if we started to lose these beds? Are we already seeing a decline?
Yes, there's been a quite a large decline in the coverage of seagrass over the last several decades. In the U.S., for example, I think that it's estimated that something like 70% of the seagrass coverage has been lost. And that's a problem for a number of reasons. I mean, you can think of an analogy with grasslands on land. The grass holds the soil together. It helps build soil. It obviously supports livestock that graze on it and all kinds of animals. It's actually quite similar in the sea, that the seagrasses bind sediments together and help store organic matter. They can sequester carbon out of organic matter in the water column. They provide direct food for large animals like turtles and manatees and dugongs. But probably even more importantly, the grasses and the algae that are growing on them provide a lot of food and habitat for all kinds of small invertebrates that are at near the base of the food chain. So many fishes and shellfish use seagrass beds as nursery areas. And there are a number of commercial fisheries that depend on seagrass beds because the baby fish live in the seagrass beds, and that's an important part of their life history.
It can be quite tough to go and experiment and have a look at this kind of ecosystem in the wild, as it were. And so I understand you've done quite a lot of what you refer to as mesocosm experiments. How do you go about studying an ecosystem in the lab?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Yes, the mesocosm is the geekish word we use for trying to recreate a small version of an ecosystem. And the problem that we face is that the major herbivores, the animals that eat the plants and sort of start the process of energy flow up the food chain, in seagrass beds, those animals are primarily really small invertebrates, sea bugs, if you will. These are little crustaceans. And it's very difficult to manipulate them in the field to try and find out what they're doing. So what we've done is to bring the ecosystem into the lab, or not strictly the lab, but really outdoor tanks where we've planted seagrass and we have seawater flowing through them. And we've been able to put different kinds of animals into these grass beds to see what effect they have on the grass. So I mentioned earlier that the grass is important to the animals because it provides habitat. It's also true that some of these small animals are important to the grass. So it's what you might call a mutualistic interaction. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And the way it works is that the seagrasses can be overgrown by nuisance algae, pond scum, for example, that are superior competitors, except that these small crustaceans eat that algae and therefore create conditions that are favorable for the grass. So that's the kind of thing that we've been trying to figure out using the mesocosms that is very difficult to do in the field.
But I also understand that you've now received a grant to be able to move that out into the real ecosystems. How do you go about moving your experiments from something like these sort of fairly controlled conditions out into something where you don't necessarily have a lot of control over the variables?
There are different questions that one can ask under those different circumstances. So in the mesocosm experiments, we've been able to look in a lot of detail under highly controlled conditions at what different species are doing and manipulated the number of species of small animals to ask whether diversity makes a difference. Does it matter if you have one kind of grazer or five or six kinds of grazers? That's much more difficult to do out in the real world, so there's that disadvantage. But of course, the real world is what we really want to know about. And so what we've been able to do is to do set up simpler experiments out there where we simply get rid of all grazers, all of these small invertebrates, to find out whether that has an influence on the grass. And we've done that with a degradable insecticide that is put into a slow-release plaster block, so we can see what impact that has on the plants. But it doesn't have all of the problems associated with putting a cage out in the field, because cages can shade the grass and they attract fouling organisms and sediment and all kinds of stuff. So the questions are somewhat simpler, but of course, because they're done out in the actual seagrass beds with all of the other forces happening in nature, we get a more accurate estimate of what the effects of those grazers might be. So we've run the same experiment at 15 different sites worldwide, from Japan through both coasts of North America to Scandinavia and Portugal. And we find that there's quite a bit of variability. So in the coming year, we're hoping to try and figure out why that is. And part of it has to do with seasonality, that there are some times of year when the grazers are active and algal growth is strong, and others when that's not the case. And also there's, of course, geographic variation in what factors are most important.
And how do you see these results being used going forward? Can we use them to perhaps direct conservation efforts?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it'll certainly be important to know what the major factors influencing seagrass ecology and populations are. A lot of the work that we've done in seagrasses is uncovering the importance of some of these really small, inconspicuous marine animals that nobody ever thinks about, the bugs and slugs, if you will. Some years ago, the famous biologist E.O. Wilson said that insects are the little things that run the world, because they're very important in terms of nutrient cycling and maintaining the structure of plant communities. And I think what we're beginning to find out with some of this work is that the same thing is true in the oceans, that some of these tiny marine animals that no one pays attention to can have very large impacts on the system and are important to maintaining it in working order. I mean, we all love whales and turtles and so on, but we also need to love the bugs and slugs.
So we need to be thinking about conserving the bugs and slugs as well as the big charismatic species like turtles and manatees. That was Emmett Duffy from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science.